we make pudding shomer. Do you know what that is?
Oh, yeah. It's like...
We might have talked... I can't remember if we talked
bread about... Bread and maple syrup? Is that that?
Sort of, like, it's like a simple white cake baked in maple syrup.
Oh, okay.
So you like either pour maple syrup over your batter or like scoop your batter into maple syrup. But I can't remember. Maybe it was a... I can't remember if that... What conversation that would have... Oh, you know what? It was actually our first recording, like our first posted recording, because we were talking about what we did during the, like, food stuff that we did during the first lockdown. And I had mentioned my grandmother's apple Johnny, which was cake, like white cake baked in applesauce. And I think I drew the, or mentioned that there's lots of different kinds of cakes baked in syrup, like from all over Eastern Canada. Yeah,
my mom makes this coffee cake that's like, I don't know, I think the syrup just goes on top of it. I don't think you're dropping the cake into the syrup, but it's like strawberry rhubarb syrup, and it's like covered in it, and it just, oh man, it's so good.
So like the raw, like the raw batter is covered in it.
Yeah, and then it seeps in while it's baking, so some parts you know, are like kind of doughy and don't really bake because they're in contact with so much liquid. And yeah, oh my God, it's amazing.
And some of it on the edges probably caramelizes and stuff. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if there's like one thing, I think that like, there are a lot of things that my mom bakes that I would not want to give up, but that I have felt like I've had to give up since I've been limiting my sweets and stuff like that. But man, if somebody came to me today and said, you can never have that again, I'd be pretty sad.
I feel, I mean, I'm not, I would need to do more reading, but in my mind, steeping, like pouring syrup over already baked cakes is like something that happens all over Europe all of the time.
Right. Like totally. France and you practically Greece don't have a cake that isn't soaked in something, which makes sense because cake is dry and shitty.
I mean, pie for life, but yeah, like, I mean, not all cakes are that bad.
Okay. Also, I want to come up with a better intro. I don't really like, we like food and we, or we love food and we love to talk about it. It's okay, but I want to do something different every time or something.
That sounds like a lot of work.
If The Simpsons can do it.
What, they just had the chalkboard and the, was the saxophone part different every time?
The sofa. The sofa is the
big thing. Yeah.
Right.
Well, visual gags are easy. Anyone could do a visual gag.
Anyone could do a visual gag. All you have to do is come up with the gag. Then you have to write a bunch of... then you have to make a bunch of illustrations about it. Then you send it away to Korea. They illustrate it. They send it back. Then you say, nope, this isn't correct. Homer doesn't look right. Did you even look at the... Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Okay, fine. Let's try it again.
Well, no, it's fine.
Well, I started laughing because I thought you were going to start laughing when I said hi.
But I do think you should keep in that I want to do something different with the intro. It's kind of funny. I don't know.
I kind of like it. Yeah,
and then just a heavy sigh, and then you do the regular intro.
That's a pretty good idea. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale. How are you?
Good. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So, Alan, what are we going to talk about tonight?
We're going to talk about our earliest kitchen jobs, our very first kitchen jobs. Is that right?
Right. Origin stories, as it were.
Right, yeah.
Alan was bitten by a radioactive snail.
Oh no, we can't talk about it. Sorry if this is ruining the evergreen aspect, but
it's fun.
I mentioned to you a short while ago that I was writing a menu that was supposed to be inspired by Southern France. And I have this great book called The Food and Flavors of Haute Provence by Georgine Brennan. And
sounds like a good book.
It's really good, actually. But she talks about raising snails, and like we had just talked about or just had the conversation about it, and I just completely stumbled upon it. But she talks about, well, she just captures the snails from wild and then kind of finishes them. But she feeds them cornmeal and rosemary. And then as near as I can tell, she just salts them like as they're still alive, which seems inconceivably cruel to me. But salts them and then
I don't really think they have a nervous system. So
they absolutely like... have a just because they're invertebrates doesn't mean they have don't have a nervous system. But anyways, she describes it in this book, and I just thought it was hilariously serendipitous that I came upon that after our conversation. But
yeah, that's interesting. So how does she lure them?
I think she just
puts like lettuce out on the lawn or what?
She's in Provence, and so she just walks around and like picks them off. Leafy greens and stuff.
Oh, I see. They're just everywhere because at some point somebody was somebody brought them from somewhere else and then was raising them, and then they escaped into the wild, and now they're like a crazy invasive species.
It could be. Honestly, I don't know. I assume.
I don't know either. I'm just.
It's not ridiculous for me to think that maybe they're just a native species there, but I actually don't know enough about snails to to tell you. But anyways, I've got the blueprint. We just need the snails now.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right on. Sounds easy.
Why do we talk about... Oh, radioactive snail. Right.
Right, right.
No, my cooking...
But you weren't actually bitten by a radioactive snail.
No.
No. You were stabbed by a radioactive fork?
No, it's all much more benign than that. Do you consider your earliest kitchen jobs as like really formative or more just like... Because mine are kind of like I just kind of found myself in it and stuck around. It wasn't like a – it was basically an accident. It was almost an accident, I would say, up to a point.
Yeah, totally. I think, for me too, my earliest kitchen jobs were basically an accident. And when I say accident, I mean really I intentionally – got them because I couldn't think of anything better.
Right.
Or something, you know?
You were an adolescent and you needed a job. That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So like it's like questionable about whether I even consider my first jobs cooking jobs, but they were fast food. So, you know, it would kind of be dismissive, I guess, to not consider them cooking jobs.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you are making food, so
you're in the food service industry. That's how we should think of it, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, and so my first job was at McDonald's in Spruce Grove, and I don't know. Like, I'm sure every teenager who gets a job feels this way, but like I didn't want that job, I just wanted the money, right?
Yeah, and some adults feel that way about their jobs too, actually.
I'm sure that's true. It's too bad, but yeah, I'm sure that's the case. Although I don't know, it's kind of different. Like, I think when you're a teenager, it seems unfair that you should have to have a job to get money or something. I don't know if you ever felt that way. But... Oh, man. Alan, how about you just be my counselor? And then we can just have a session. Alan, you're a really good listener. I don't know if every teenager feels this way, but I think I felt like, you know, sort of like, it was unfair that I had to, Yeah, yeah, entitled, fully, yeah, like 100%, like entitled to like having my needs met in terms of having money and you know, like, and being able to like have money to do things that I wanted to do, but not necessarily understanding why I had to work to get that money.
Right.
But I think it's, I certainly hope that for most adults, there's like a much more sort of well understood connection between why those things are the way they are. And so even if you don't necessarily, you know, like if you're choosing your job because you need the money, you know, I think like as an adult, you can better recognize the like connection between those two things and the necessity that for you to, you know, like put some effort into something in order to get something out. I don't know.
Right.
Just, yeah, I don't know. I think I had a hard time seeing that as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I was a terrible McDonald's employee. Like I did what was needed to make the, you know, to do my job and you know, in order for the food to get into the hot window.
Right.
But yeah, I was a crappy teenager with a bad work ethic.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, like actually in retrospect, it's like pretty unbelievable. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot different in the city where you actually have grown-up people who need jobs and get jobs in fast food, mm-hmm. you know, like, but in Spruce Grove, like there were the managers were adults at that McDonald's, but mm-hmm. like every employee pretty much was a teenager.
Is that like, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
which
I would say like, or the vast majority,
which was bad for the work environment. You mean?
I just, no, what I was going to say is that like, I think it's pretty amazing that they can run a business mm-hmm. with like most of their workforce just being disgruntled teenagers who don't actually really want to be there mm-hmm. and still like, you know, put out consistent product and have a clean, quote unquote, clean restaurant.
Whoa.
And yeah, I mean, it was a McDonald's in the 90s. So,
but you mean that it speaks to their systems design basically, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's pretty amazing. Like I think, and like, you know, it's not like I didn't learn anything working there. I learned how the systems worked, you know? Mm-hmm. And I learned why they worked the way they worked. And I learned a lot about streamlining things and, mm-hmm. and being able to like organize something like to get it done quickly.
Is that right?
And yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. A bunch of stuff that like, I still have in the back of my head in terms of how to organize systems in restaurants. I think like, you know, it's not necessarily like ripped from systems at McDonald's. It's more like, you know, based on various systems that I've, you know, worked in while, you know, coming up through my career or whatever, mm-hmm. but definitely it opened my eyes, to, you know, like how things can be organized in that way mm-hmm. and sort of like probably started to change my brain a little bit about, you know, how you can get a lot done with a little effort if you just organize things in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I might've mentioned this to you before. I remember distinctly in culinary school, one of my instructors saying specifically that, he thought, I don't know if he said every one of you should go work at McDonald's for a period of time, or if it was just that anyone could learn something working at McDonald's from the systems organization perspective,
right?
Which I obviously understand the I understand now what could be learned there. I'd be skeptical if like everyone who goes through a McDonald's kitchen like leaves understanding how to organize a workstation necessarily, but
yeah, no, it's not really that. It's more like just, you know, like it was my first exposure really to any kind of like workplace where there are several people working and they're working together as a team, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, in that way, it was like pretty eye-opening, you mm-hmm. know, like it just.
I've not worked at a McDonald's, but I mm-hmm. do think about McDonald's a lot in terms of, like workspace organization and economy of movement and things like that. I think.
Right.
Probably especially because, have you seen the movie The Founder with Michael Keaton?
Yeah, I have seen it, yeah.
About Ray Kroc.
That's a food movie that we have never talked about.
Yeah, hey, that'd be a good one. Write it down. Yeah. but there's a scene where the McDonald brothers have their kitchen crew on a tennis court, and they've chalked right. out on the court the various workstations and pieces of equipment, and they're trying to reorganize their line to make it as quick and efficient as possible. And I think about that all the time, like in simple line setups, like why is this here? Why is it like, why can't I stand here and reach this and that and like stuff like mm-hmm. that? So I haven't worked at McDonald's, but I do think that I could probably learn a lot from visiting a McDonald's kitchen.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know this for sure, but I think McDonald's originated a lot of those types of systems. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of other fast food restaurants, you know, like their systems are, you know, a lot of ways ripped from McDonald's playbook.
You know, which fast food restaurant has not ripped a single page from McDonald's is Harvey's. Harvey's was my, like, we went to McDonald's every once in a while, but when I was growing up, Harvey's was like our, like if we're on a road trip, we're stopping at Harvey's. Mm-hmm. And just in the last few weeks, I ate at a Harvey's.
I got your back, Alan. I like Harvey's, honestly. I haven't had it in a long time now, but
I think it was,
I'm down.
In the last few weeks, the first time I ate at a Harvey's certainly in years. I couldn't say how many. But it was like stepping into a time machine. Like they take your order, they print a bill, they smack the bill on top of a brown paper bag and put it on top of a counter. And the only way they have to keep the chits organized at this location anyways, was to keep the bags in order. And they
I think that's every Harvey's, like any Harvey's that I've ever seen. Yeah.
They didn't.
So either, it's either they either have a bag if you're taking your order to go, or they have like a cafeteria tray if you're taking your order to stay. And then they take the chit that comes out of the printer and put it on your, and then there's like three people working dressing sandwiches. Yeah,
but wait, before the condiments, either they didn't have, or they've chose to not use any kind of unique identifier on the bill. And so the way they would call it, when an order was ready to be garnished or ready to be picked up, they just called mm-hmm. out the order, like the list of food items that had been ordered. And so there was like five people waiting for orders, and someone took someone else's order. And so they, and they just couldn't figure it out.
Right.
And then anyways, and then yes, I understand the allure of being able to build your own burger and stuff, but like it was, it really felt like going back in time, where it's like, this is taking forever. Like I've got five people in front of me in line, and this guy's getting 18 different toppings on his burger. And anyways,
yeah, legit. It's like painful when you walk in and it's busy. You're like, I've like walked into a Harvey's and just left before, when there was like just like three people in line in front of me. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to be here for like half an hour. That's not. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't weird to me growing up, but just having not been around it for so long, and I guess like been kind of like seeing the very modern systems at a place like McDonald's, it really shocked me, actually.
No, you're right. It is shockingly bad. And yeah, they often do get disorganized, and then nobody knows what they're doing, and then they're trying to figure it out amongst themselves, but nobody's really communicating. And the person who took the order is like standing over there still taking orders. And mm-hmm. so, mm-hmm. you know, like nobody really knows what's going on. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
What are we but really even talking that, about? Though,
We're talking about systems. Okay. And even at Harvey's, that's what's happening up at the front with the people who are putting together the orders. But in the back, they still do have systems for how often they cook certain foods,
right.
And
yeah, well, that, makes
that
sense.
Type of stuff. So it's much more systematized, in the non-customer facing aspect of it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the way they cook their fries and, you know, and everything else that's on the menu is much more, I think, like a McDonald's type of situation.
Right.
Just like, then it hits this like wall of, condiment dressing, and mm-hmm. customer interaction that is like still not effective. I think that there is a way to make that type of system much more effective. Like Subway seems to do an okay, like a better job at it anyways. Like Subway is a situation where you can kind of get whatever you want on your sandwich, right? And I've rarely run into a situation at Subway where somebody takes the wrong order. Like there's mm-hmm. one person and they stick with you until your order basically gets paid for. So
right, that's true. Yeah.
But yeah, maybe it's a little different because at Subway, you pay for your order after the sandwich is made. At Harvey's, you pay for your order up front and then they make it for you. So the system may not really quite work the same way. They should flip it. You should go in, tell the person that's making your burger what you want, and then.
Or like, can you
should
tell?
Should we write them a letter? Maybe we can.
Open letter. We'll publish it in the journal. Yeah. Oh, but Shale, I think that we should write an open letter to the mayor and city council of the city of Nanaimo to have them change the official Nanaimo bar recipe to have salt in the base.
Oh, what a great idea.
I'm going to write that letter. I don't know why. Okay. I was thinking about it again this week, our Nanaimo bar conversation, but
yeah. I was thinking about it too, actually, because a friend of mine, Clayton, you know Clayton,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Friend of the show, Clayton, was kind of laying into me for calling out the joy of cooking, even mm-hmm. though I had just recently called myself out for calling out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So friend of the show, Clayton, was telling me that there's a lot of you know, really good utility recipes in the joy of cooking. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And he was like, I'll bet there's a Nanaimo bar recipe in there. I was like, there's no way there's a Nanaimo bar recipe in the joy of cooking. So I had him look it up for me. There's not.
Yeah. I don't know actually where it was published out of, but to me, joy of cooking is very, Eastern United States. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Which, like, you know, in an era where Nanaimo bars would not really have percolated down mm-hmm. to the, you know, so mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in fact, they probably still haven't. Like, you know, if you ask somebody in Boston what a Nanaimo bar is, they probably have no freaking clue what you're talking about.
Yeah. If they don't know what a coffee crisp is, they definitely don't know what a Nanaimo bar is, I would say.
And don't eat their Smarties.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, I wouldn't say that I didn't learn anything at McDonald's, but I certainly wasn't ready to have it. Well, I mean, I should have been ready to have a job, but I wasn't really. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did lots of bad stuff at my job. Like I used to sell my hat.
What do you mean?
Like people would come in and be like, hey man, I'll give you $5 for your hat. Cause like, it was like a cool thing to wear like a McDonald's visor if you didn't work there.
Oh really?
Yeah. Like ironically.
Oh, I see.
Or something. Yeah.
I don't think I ever came across that.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's
it like
Alberta
a punk thing?
I don't know. Yeah. It was kind of a punk thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I sold hats to a couple people who came in and were like, "Hey man, you should sell me your hat." And
was
then
it lucrative?
I told, no, not very. Oh. I mean, not as much as working was. Not that working was very lucrative. I think when I started working there, there was a minimum wage for people under 18, which was lower than the actual minimum wage.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly what the minimum wage was when I started, but I was making, like, I don't know what the adult minimum wage was, but I think when I started, I was making $4.25 an hour.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Can you imagine that?
No.
Luckily, I didn't need a lot of money. I don't
right.
know.
Yeah.
I wasn't supporting a family. But yeah. And yeah, I mean, like I was saying, at least in the suburbs, everyone that worked there was just kind of like a teenager. Some people were much more into the job than I was, and some people were even less so, I think. But yeah, I worked there for a fair amount of time. I don't exactly remember how long, but probably a year for sure.
Is that right?
Yeah. Maybe a little longer than a year. And I worked a lot of different stations in the back. I never really worked up front, I don't think. But yeah, I learned a lot. I worked breakfast. I learned how to make egg McMuffins.
Oh, really? I was going to ask you. Like,
actually, what's that?
Well, I was going to ask you if there was anything like, like a specific food preparation, not like a general systems or organization or that kind of thing, but like actually food handling, if there was anything that you learned, like, because I know obviously like the reputation is that it all comes out of boxes and bags and stuff, but like they do cook the eggs, right? Like they cook the eggs for
they
the
do
egg
cook
muffins,
the eggs,
so like that would be something that
well, some of them, like, well, I mean they cook all the eggs, but I mean they, a lot of their breakfasts now don't have like fresh cracked eggs. They just have like scrambled eggs that come out of a carton.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like anything that you get at McDonald's that has scrambled eggs on it, I think the eggs just come out of a carton. But for like, yeah, the egg McMuffins, sausage McMuffins, what else has like a whole egg on it? I can't even remember.
The bacon McMuffin.
All the McMuffins. anyways, I'm actually working up to something. But don't forget what you were going to say. But yeah, there is like, I mean, it's not just systems. Like you do learn about how to like set up a station, even though it's very specific, right? Like, it doesn't really apply very well anywhere else because they have very specific equipment and they have, you know, like they like you don't, even in like a lot of other fast food restaurants, like you put ketchup on a bun with like a spreader. But like at McDonald's, you don't do that. There's a gun.
A sauce gun. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, the one thing that I did learn at McDonald's that is like specifically actual like technique, food handling, is how to crack an egg with one hand, or like how to crack two eggs at once with both hands.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. It was necessary to be able to crack two eggs at once, you know, and do it fairly cleanly to be able to crack eggs fast enough to make egg McMuffins when it was busy. And so, yeah, somebody taught me how to like pick up an egg in each hand and then crack them one handed. And I got pretty fast at it. And I still use that skill all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't often use the two hand thing unless I'm cracking like a million eggs. But
that does seem like for a restaurant that's synonymous with consistency, like it seems like the kind of task where there's going to be an eggshell in someone's sandwich at some point in the day with that. So it's surprising to me that they do operate that way.
Yeah. And I've definitely ordered an egg McMuffin and gotten an eggshell in my egg McMuffin before.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's happened a few times, I would say. I mean, yeah, I think it's not totally uncommon, but I don't know. Like it's pretty, you know, like they teach you to check.
Right.
But I'm sure that there are lots of teenagers who don't give a shit about their job that don't check ever. But yeah. And, you know, like you're cracking them into this like little round egg mold thing that cooks them in the exact like diameter that they need to be. And yep. You know what they're like. Yeah. So, but yeah, I did learn how to crack eggs.
Yeah.
And I kind of learned how to like wash dishes.
Yeah.
Sort of. Yeah. So I definitely learned some stuff. I learned how to have a job, I guess, right. is like the biggest thing. mm-hmm. yeah. And then I also worked at a Wendy's in Spruce Grove.
Oh, yeah. And how similar or different was that to McDonald's?
I mean, it was very similar, I would say. There were a few subtle differences. Like Wendy's had a salad bar. So there was like, you know, the dine-in restaurant, we were kind of keeping fresh food fresh.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, you know, there was that. It was like setting up the salad bar and making it look nice every day. That was sort of like a different thing that we didn't really do at all at mm-hmm. McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And I guess like, one of the bigger differences is that like at McDonald's, at least when I worked there, all of the meat was frozen.
Yeah.
And all of the meat at Wendy's was not frozen.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was kind of a difference. It didn't really affect me too much. I'm sure it affected how they did their ordering and stuff like that and what their supply chain is like, but it didn't really affect me too much.
I thought for sure you're going to say the big difference was that at McDonald's, the meat patties were round. And at Wendy's, the meat patties were square. So it was back to square one. Yeah.
There's, oh, God. I'm cutting that.
What?
For sure. Oh. Just kidding. I'm leaving it in. And you're going to have to be the one who has to deal with it. I mean, they did have a special technique to try and make sure that the patties stayed square-ish when you cooked them. So
was that right?
I mean, there was that. Yeah. The four corner press, they called it.
Oh, really? Sounds like a basketball offensive strategy.
It totally does. Yeah. And also, I remember at both places, I had to watch like corporate videos on how to do all of the jobs before I did the jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Those videos, they're the worst. Actually, I bet they're all on YouTube.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe lawsuits or something. Oh, there's a few, Alan.
Yeah.
This is a whole episode. Yeah. Anyways, yeah. So I had a few fast food jobs before I really ever got a cooking job. I also worked at Pizza Hut. I had a little more like, I think when I worked at Pizza Hut, I was starting to like get over being like totally entitled and irresponsible. Mm-hmm. Cause I had a little more responsibility when I worked at Pizza Hut. I was like making dough when I would go in the mornings and rolling out a bunch of doughs. Like, and I would work in the mornings unsupervised and yeah.
Cool.
I kind of liked that job. I didn't like having to get up early in the morning, but I liked that, you know, I had a certain amount of tasks that I could do on my own and I would just do them and it wouldn't, you know, there wouldn't be somebody breathing down my neck the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want me to just keep moving on? I'm counting that all as one job. Three fast food jobs.
That's classic.
Yeah, before I ever had like an actual, what I would consider to be like a real cooking job, I had three fast food jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, like I said, I didn't hate working at Pizza Hut, but I didn't like any of my jobs up to that point, I don't think. But I think at the time, like I was kind of into food. Like not in any kind of serious way, but like I knew quite a bit about food and I had quite a bit of exposure to it. Mm-hmm. And I was always interested in it when I was younger. So I think that in the back of my head, I was kind of like, well, maybe I could like, you know, be a cook or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
I was sort of still trying to figure out what I wanted to do long-term career-wise. I also had in the back of my head that I wanted to be a filmmaker, but like that was a very nebulous path. And so I wasn't really sure what to do about it. And I still needed to have jobs. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then once you have experience working in fast food, you can kind of potentially parlay that into some kind of entry level position in like a real restaurant, mm-hmm. Which is what I did. So I guess when I was like, I would have been 19 or 20, mm-hmm. I got my first job at an actual restaurant. It was called the Turtle Creek Cafe.
Mm-hmm. On 9th Street.
It was 109th Street, yeah, mm-hmm. in Edmonton, on the south side. Mm-hmm. 109th Street and what, like 84th Avenue or something like that? 84th, 85th
yeah.
Avenue or
something. Yeah,
something
like that.
Yeah. I don't know what's there now.
Well, actually, I was going to quickly ask, like, what was the connection between Turtle Creek and Cafe Select? Was there any?
Actually, I'm not really sure. There might have been some kind of ownership connection there. But I don't really know. And I didn't know enough about like the owners and stuff when I worked there to really know that. I mean, now that you mention it, that kind of rings a bell. Mm-hmm. But certainly when I was working at Turtle Creek Cafe, there was never any, like, I never had anyone ask me if I, you know, wanted to take a shift at another place or anything like that. So I don't really know.
Just so anyone who's familiar with the area can picture where we're talking about, when I moved into the area, it was either Turtle Creek Cafe or Cafe Select. And then afterwards, it was an original Joe's. And now, if I can picture it clearly, part of it is vacant and part of it is a Domino's. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But just south
of where... Yeah, I definitely went there a couple times when it was original Joe's. Yeah. I didn't really realize that it was Cafe Select.
I might be confused, but I thought that over the course of the years that I've lived in that neighborhood that it went from Turtle Creek to Cafe Select, but I'm
certainly possible.
What was the, like, specifically the transition to that job? Was it just like you saw a posting and you applied, or was there some kind of personal connection or
I think I was friends with a guy who was working there as a server, mm-hmm. and I think that was it. And I'm not exactly sure why I wanted to, because I basically went from working at Pizza Hut on White Ave to working at Turtle Creek Cafe, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure why I wanted to leave Pizza Hut. I don't really remember that part of it, or maybe I had left and I didn't have another job, something like that, mm-hmm. and I was looking for one, and so my friend was like, oh well, you should apply, they're looking for cooks. And so I did. Yeah. And so that was like my first actual cooking job, mm-hmm. and that was intense.
How so? Just the level of responsibility and speed, or
what? Yeah, like I still didn't have a very good work ethic, which is like kind of okay at a fast food restaurant. They just have systems and you have to do things in a certain amount of time, and you know, like, you're not really that self-regulated, you know,
because things beep at you if you don't do them fast enough.
Kind of. Yeah. Exactly. Or you just like, but yeah, at a real restaurant, you're not always just directly making food for a customer that needs it right now or something, you know, like there's like prep that needs to be done, and you know, there are prep jobs that you like or don't like, and you know, like, and there are certain things that you want to do and other things that you don't want to do. And like, yeah. So, and it was a very busy restaurant. Like, mm-hmm. at the mm-hmm. time that I worked there, it was like one of the more popular restaurants in the city, I think. And it had a fairly big dining room.
Mm-hmm. I remember it having a lot of goodwill around it, like kind of like the way that an institution like the High Level Diner does, where it just like has almost like generations of people who grew up going there and just, love
it's just
the
like their go-to place. And everybody talks about it, and mm-hmm. everyone knows about it, and everyone just goes there. Yeah.
Do you remember much about what the actual food was like there at that time?
I don't remember tons. I know that it was quite fusion-y. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that it was sort of like casual fine dining-ish kind mm-hmm. of, as much as that sort of existed back then. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that you could get like a steak, you know, a steak and fries or something like that. And you could also get, like, they had pasta dishes on the menu that were kind of fancy. And then they had a couple pasta dishes that were sort of more like Asian dishes. Like, maybe I'm misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure they had like a pasta dish that was like fettuccine and it had like a black bean sauce and chicken.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Like a fermented.
Yeah. So it was like, a fermented black bean sauce. Like you would find like, you know, like a Chinese style black bean sauce. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. it was like the sauce for like fettuccine with chicken. I'm pretty sure that was a dish.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like kind of fusion-y. I'm pretty sure the chef when I was working there was Asian.
Oh, was right. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really have too much contact with the chef.
Right.
I had like contact with the sous chefs, and I think potentially they did have another restaurant and the chef worked between both restaurants. He wasn't always at our location or whatever, but I did learn like quite a few prep jobs. I don't remember like most of them, but I learned how to like cook big batches of rice and things like that, and learned how to like, you know, par cook pasta. And what else did I do? Like I made a lot of like tomato sauce and things like that. Shredded a lot of cheese. We had like a pizza night once a week that was just like the craziest night. It would just be packed from open to close.
Yeah.
And we would make like, we had the one little kind of like deck pizza oven, like, you know, like a single door pizza oven where it's just like, you know, a big long rectangle that goes back about 6 feet or something.
Yeah.
We would cook like personal size pizzas, one night of the week. I can't remember what night it was, but it was just madness. And I would work the pizza oven with another cook, usually an experienced cook. There was a cook there named Jimmy who kind of like took me under his wing. He was like a cool guy. He liked cool music, and you know, we kind of like got along. And so even though I didn't really have a very good work ethic and, you know, probably cared about the job less than he would have liked, you know, I think that he thought that you know, he could sort of encourage me to like the job more and work harder if we sort of like got along. And so he kind of like befriended me and took me under his wing. And he was like a really experienced cook, and he'd been cooking there for quite a while, I think. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes on pizza nights, I would work with him on the pizza oven, and we would just be like
slinging za,
putting out like, yeah, like 60 pizzas an hour or something like ridiculous out of this like little oven.
Well, what, Shale, I'm not trying to timestamp anything, but just giving me your response can be one band. What was the cool? What was cool music?
So what did Jimmy listen to that I got into because he recommended it to me? I mean, he listened to like a lot of weird classic rock.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
A lot of like weird old bands. That's probably the best example. Like, yeah. I think that I had never heard Frank Zappa before, before I knew Jimmy. So okay. He, yeah.
Okay.
And like Captain Beefheart, you know, Captain Beefheart is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of stuff like that. And I think he was into some like newer music that was cool and stuff too, but he was into like a lot of weird classic rock, which was pretty fun.
I didn't want to derail you, but that we've talked about like music in kitchens and how that can be a point of bonding or like something that just tears a kitchen apart. But so I was curious to know what you meant exactly. But anyways, pizza. Yeah. I can picture, as I assume it's pan pizzas, right?
Yeah, it's like individual little pan pizzas, and they're in these like little eight inch rounds or something.
I can imagine how crazy.
I'm sure you can picture the line set up exactly in your mind, like how the ingredients are laid out. There's like a big like half size hotel pan that's full of cheese, and then there's like a big half size hotel pan that's full of sauce, and then there's like, you know, all of the other possible toppings have their own like individually sized containers based on how much you go through in an evening, and you have backups of everything in a reach in, and then you have like double backups of everything in the walk-in, and somebody's running to the walk-in to grab more like, you know, pieces of ham or whatever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was exactly a pizza station. Exactly how you would imagine it. And yeah, we were like rotating the pizzas through the oven and like, you know, using a peel to like put things in at the front and then like kind of rotate them in like a counterclockwise direction or something. And like, so we would be putting them in, and then every like 2 minutes or something, we would like open the oven and pull the ones out that were ready from one side. And then we would just sort of shuffle everything in that direction so that they would kind of move through in an organized way. Yeah. So that was fun. That was like my first real like line cooking exposure, and yeah, it was good. I definitely like learned more what it was like to work in a kitchen when I was working there. And right. I did have fun doing those things sometimes when it was like really busy. But like the long and short of it is that basically by working there, I discovered that I hated cooking and I never wanted to do it again.
Oh, no.
Because it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like it's hard work. It's, there's a lot of stress. You know, people yell at you. I didn't like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not great, and it shouldn't necessarily be the way things are, but that's what it was like. And so, yeah, it was tough. It was stressful. It was a lot of hard work, and I was just like, man, this is not worth it. Yeah. And then I basically decided that I never wanted to have cooking as a job again, but then I quit that job. Maybe I was fired. I don't exactly remember what happened.
If you don't remember, you were fired. I'm just kidding.
Maybe. I think it was like a little bit of both. I don't know. I think they kind of like, I think I told them I was quitting and that I wasn't going to show up for my shifts or something. And then they were like, well, then you're fired or something. I don't know.
You can't quit. You're fired.
Yeah, exactly.
Classic. Yeah.
But then like not long after that, obviously I still needed to have a job. And so another friend of mine, Brian Lambert, he got me a job at the power plant where he was working, I think, at the time. I don't know if he worked there for the whole time that I worked there, but I only worked there for like 3 months or something.
Yeah.
And oh my God, that was the craziest. That was just like such a shit show, Alan. So the power plant's a bar on the University of Alberta campus.
Yes.
Is it still there? Must be, right? Yeah.
It is.
What else are they going to do with that building?
I mean, I haven't been there since I was a student, but I imagine that it operates very differently now than it did even when I was there, I think.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you're right.
When you say it was a shit show, do you mean in terms of the food service operation or just?
Yeah. So they had, it was like a restaurant, and then it was like a nightclub in the evenings or something. But yeah, the food was bad.
Okay.
And like, I don't even remember really what we made. I have like one memory of food that I made while I was working at that place. And that is, I learned exactly how you make jambalaya. Do you want me to tell you how?
Yeah.
Okay. First, you get a lot of parboiled rice. And then you put that in a hotel pan. And then you cut up some andouille sausage. And you put that also in the hotel pan with it. And then you take a whole bunch of turmeric and you sprinkle that inside the hotel pan.
Okay.
And then some salt and pepper. And then you fill the hotel pan with water, and then you put it in the oven for like 35 minutes. And then you have jambalaya.
Oh.
Easy, Alan.
I mean, what do I say?
Well, it's not fair because
one of my first kitchen jobs was at Daddy-O, so I feel like I have a much more nuanced understanding of the dish. But for a lot of people,
what jambalaya like, should be like, yeah.
Rice and pork and... Honestly, the only thing I remember eating at Power Plant, and I'm sure I had other stuff, but like hamburgers. Like it's a hamburger and fries kind of... It's a bar, right? Like that's what I remember having there.
Yeah, and I think that's mostly like a lot of what they had when I was working there too, but I honestly really do not remember. I don't even think I ever worked on the line. I don't know. Maybe I only worked there as a prep cook or something. I'm not sure. But yeah, it was just horrible, and the owners were awful. And like I would show up to work like in the morning, and the owners would be like locked in the office with like people that they'd been partying with like the night before, and they like were all passed out in like the office, and people would like not have their clothes on, and like it was just like just the most despicably toxic, disgusting place to work.
That really surprises me. Like, because I would think, I mean, that it being I'm a sure business was operating on a post-secondary campus, that there would be like either a larger corporate food service company in charge of it, or like it's somehow integrated into like some kind of food service operations union that operates on. I don't know. That really surprises me.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess it was a different time. I don't really know how that all worked at the time. It's possible that it was like supposed to be owned and operated by some kind of company that operated a bunch of the food services, food service operations on campus or something like that. But definitely it was like managed independently.
Yeah.
And also like they had a lot of live music there.
Yeah.
And so a large part of like running it, I think, was like booking acts and doing like that kind of promo and stuff like that. And like that world is very different. I don't know. Anyways, horrible place to work. I think I only worked there for 3 months or something.
Yeah. Kate.
And then after that, I swore I would never, ever have another cooking job ever again in my life.
This time
I hated it.
For real. Like, it's permanent this time.
This time for real.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you had your West Coast sojourn, right? Is that the next chapter?
Or no? And then I didn't have a cooking job for a really long time after that. 10 years at least.
Oh, really? That long? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I think I would have been 20. And then I think I actually, it was right around 10 years, because I think I got my actual first cooking job when I was 30.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was, you're right, it was in Vancouver. And I was in Vancouver because I was looking to get into the film industry. Mm-hmm. And that was not really happening. But a friend of mine and I made a short film. I probably talked about this before. We made a short film independently. It's in the Lost Recording.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair. We were making an independent short film, and we needed a place to edit it. And we basically like sold everything we had and gave up the apartments that we were living in just to be able to afford to make the film that we wanted to make. And one of us needed to have a job so we could have an apartment in which we could edit our movie. And so I got a dishwashing job at Havana on Commercial Drive in Vancouver. And I just got it because I needed a job and I knew somebody who worked there. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history. I fell in love with cooking while I was working there.
Did you rock, paper, scissors with your partner, or how did you...
About who was going to get a job?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, we didn't really rock, paper, scissors. I think it was just, one of us was, I think we were both looking and I just happened to get one. He probably got a job too. Probably a couple weeks later, but I just don't remember.
Is Havana, dumb question, is it a Cuban restaurant?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it certainly was at the time, or it was like pseudo-Cuban, I guess. Mm-hmm. The decor is very Cuban. It looks like an old Cuban building. Like, it looks like a building ripped straight out of Havana. They put a lot of work into making it look like an old Cuban building.
Cool.
That was pretty cool. And then, yeah, they had like a medianoche on the menu, like Cuban sandwich. Mm-hmm.
Everything I know about Cuban food, I know from the movie Chef. So you don't feel like you're talking down to me or dumbing things down. I don't know anything about it.
Right. Yeah. But like, you know, they had a lot of just like other regular Western North American food on the menu as well. Mm-hmm. But then they also tried to do like a lot of, interesting features and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sangria was like a huge thing. Mm-hmm. People would come and sit on the patio there and drink sangria all day.
Yeah.
I don't remember everything about it, but yeah. I mean, it was like a pretty regular North American restaurant for the most part. Had sandwiches and burgers and things like that, and pastas and and stuff. But yeah, it did have like a Cuban sandwich and I think it may have had a couple other sort of like Cuban specialties. Yeah, and I don't know, like it's not like it was like the greatest restaurant ever or something, but the food was quite good. Mm-hmm. But just there were like a few key people who were working there that I got along with and really like really tried to, you know, show me how to succeed. Mm-hmm. In a restaurant. And I really like, so for quite a few years, like for 10 years, I'd been doing mostly like I went to school, for film and things like that. And then I was working in like multimedia and like, graphic design for the web and things like that for mm-hmm. quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And so I was mostly working a desk job a lot of the time with like, you know, long deadlines and things like that. And something about like going back to working in a kitchen and doing something with my hands immediately, and seeing the result immediately and just like having everything happen, it was just very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of hooked me. Like yeah. That was the big thing that hooked me about it, was like you're doing something immediate with your hands and you know you see the result right away. Mm-hmm. You're not working on like a 2-year project where your contribution may not show up until like the last 2 months of a project or something. Mm-hmm. You know, like yeah.
I had kind of a similar experience going from office jobs to cooking, where I felt like when I had a job where I was like my workstation was sitting in front of a computer, even at the mm-hmm. times when I was like relatively engaged in the work that was happening, I still found myself like watching the clock a lot, partly because the mm-hmm. clock is watching you, like there's a clock like right under your nose all the time. But and it gave me like quite a bit of anxiety, and I really felt like I'm literally just counting the minutes and hours of the rest of my life. But then after right. my first shift or two in a kitchen, I was like, I just did a 9-hour shift and I didn't look at the clock at all. Like not once.
Right. And it feels like it went by in like 4 hours.
Yeah. 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 And like, which I don't know, when I say it out loud now, it makes it sound like the time flies and you don't like have any time for reflection or, I don't know, but I
well, it's
pretty accurate, but
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, it makes it sound like the time that you spent there wasn't enjoyable or important and it was just like a mad rush, but like it,
right.
I don't know. I felt very different leaving work after a kitchen shift than I did after an office shift. And I felt good. Like I had expended energy and accomplished something and didn't just like,
right. You did something satisfying, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Yeah.
Which I'm sure people who work, I'm sure there's lots of people who work in front of computers who can feel that way at the end of a work day. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but I didn't feel that way.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And that was sort of the magic of it for me. It was like doing something with my hands. Like it was just, it felt like a totally different thing. Suddenly I was like, oh, I'm like actually connected to this thing that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm sure it's not that way for everyone, but for me, that was like a big part of it that really got its hooks into me. Mm-hmm. It was just like immediately seeing a result for something that you're working on right now. Mm-hmm. It was, yeah, mm-hmm. super refreshing. So yeah, why don't you tell me about yours, Alan?
My very first kitchen job was at a place called Hulbert's, which does not exist anymore, but it was a small, mm-hmm. Like a coffee house, that did lunch and dinners and had a small stage for, open mics and live performances and karaoke and stuff like that.
Cool.
And I didn't, I was not really particularly interested in food for most of my childhood and young adulthood, but was in my last term at engineering at U of A, and this place, Hulbert's, opened up like 2 blocks away from where I was staying. And I just needed a job and wanted to put cash in the bank to fund a trip for after I was done school. So got a job in that kitchen.
Did you just walk by and they had a, like a help wanted sign or what?
I honestly don't know. I'm sure it was something like that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Cause it, yeah, like I said, it was just two blocks from my house. That's probably how it happened. And the food there, I don't remember that much about it, but I was very, like soup, salad, sandwich, quesadilla. They had some, like a small entree menu for the evenings that had like, I don't know what, baked salmon and things like that. The kitchen was tiny. Mm-hmm. It had like one little combi oven and then one kind of mid-sized convection, one workbench, one small dish pit, one walk-in cooler that was more like a step-in cooler. Like you couldn't go into it and spread your arms out or anything. But I liked it well enough. And by the time I finished engineering and had done a few work placements, like over the course of the degree, I knew I wasn't particularly interested in finding work in the field. And so I just stayed at that Hulbert's place. And then at some point the owners offered to pay for me to go to culinary school, and it was,
happening
at a weird, like watershed moment where, like I had, been dating Lisa for a short while, and she was like getting us into some really, really interesting food projects at home. Like we were like cooking loads, but we were part of like a community supported agriculture program where we'd like put time in at a farm to get vegetables through the summer and slow food and stuff like that. I took them up on the offer to go to culinary school and applied and got accepted. But then Hulbert's closed before I started culinary school. And so obviously they rescinded the offer because they didn't have a restaurant that they needed a cook for anymore.
Right.
And so my next job was because Hulbert's, even though like it could be quite busy on nights where there were performances, it was such a small shop. I wanted my next job to be, because I was thinking I would make a run at cooking as a career, I wanted it to be at the busiest place that I knew existed, like the busiest, loudest, like greasiest place that I knew of. And that
you wanted it to be greasy.
Well, I mean, like a different, kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just like fast, large volume kind of place. And so for me at the time, that was Daddy-O on White.
Right.
Which I love. I always loved that place. Like would go there for po' boys and sweet potato fries often.
Totally.
So it's like a Cajun and New Orleans style, diner on White Avenue.
Was it ever like a thought in your mind to work at a chain restaurant? Like, what was it about Daddy-O? Because like there are plenty of super busy restaurants, you know, in Edmonton that are like, you know, putting out tons of food and, you know.
Do you mean like an Earl's kind
chains?
Of?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't remember considering that. I think that would have been a great route too, to be honest. I feel like Earl's kind of has a lot of the like systems that we were talking about with McDonald's. I'm not talking bad about it. Like it's a fact. They have a lot more corporate.
I mean, they have to. Yeah. You know, like it's
Yeah. So I've worked with lots of people who came through those kitchens. But I don't know if it was just because I was coming at it from the like the slow food and like local, small local end of it. Like my heroes were like Blair Lebsack. And I opted for Daddy-O. That was also a fun kitchen, very different, like a much bigger crew than we would have had at Hulbert's. Kind of like an oddly segregated kitchen where there was like this crew of older, like Chinese Vietnamese ladies who did all of the prep work. And then the like actual line crew when I was there anyways tended to be like, it was all like young white kids,
white dudes,
but all White Avenue punk rocker type kids.
Right.
Not that I was a White Avenue punk rocker, but that.
Oh, Alan, that's you to a T. Tell me you didn't have pizza at the Funky Pickle. Come
of course
on.
I did, but I wouldn't say I was ever punk.
I know, I'm just kidding around.
So yeah, Daddy-O, I started on the fry station. I was the fry cook. So mm-hmm. big, I don't remember there being hood vents of any kind at Hulbert's. Like it was just cause we had two ovens and they were probably direct exhaust or something. But like, so it went from that to this, like a deep fryer that's just like the size of my bathtub basically. And so much of that menu comes out of the fryer because of the sweet potato.
It's like one big long fryer.
No, it was the segmented, like it had three bays or whatever in it. But all told, it was probably
not like you find in the UK where they like not like at the Chippy or whatever.
Oh, I haven't seen that where they have ones that are actually just like a bathtub or.
Oh yeah, they're like just huge long fryers. They're like, you know, 6 or 8 feet long, and it's just one big long bath, and they just put stuff straight into it. They like don't even use baskets most of the time.
No, it wasn't like that. But yeah, between the sweet potato fries and the fried chicken and the fried oysters and there was a lot of stuff going in and out of that fryer.
Yeah, totally.
And it's a fun station, kind of like dishwashing, where it's like, I guess there's some more nuance to the timing and stuff, but it's like things go in the basket, they go down, they go up, they go to the line, like they go to the pass. That's kind of like, and it, so it's
yeah,
fun
exactly.
To just
like there's never an empty basket. As soon as there's an empty basket, there's something else going in it like immediately. Yeah, yeah. And it's just like a rotation of trying to keep things down as much as possible.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So it was fun.
Whereas when you're working in the dishwasher, you're trying to keep that machine running all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a parameter constraint problem, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or a bottleneck problem. But I think there was one particular cook at Daddy-O who for the brief time that I was there, I was only there for a season, from July to Christmas or something like that. There was a guy there named Kim, and he had done mm-hmm. more heavy cooking in his career. Like I think he had been the sous chef at what was the name of the restaurant that was in the, it was on the main floor of the Varscona Hotel there. Starts with an M. Marietta's.
Oh,
Marietta's,
yeah.
which had a few locations, I think, in its day. But anyways, he kind of lit a bit of a fire under me and exposed me to some broader ideas on cooking and cooking culture, and maybe was the guy who told me to read Anthony Bourdain.
Right.
But more importantly, the two lessons I remember for him were, hey, you're doing good on the fry station. You should start paying attention to what the guy on the pan station is doing. And once I was on pan station, it was like, you should be watching the expediter, because like, I think you want to be the expediter. And so that kind of idea of intentionally pushing yourself to master your station, but also like learn the next station and kind of go up. But the other...
Yeah, totally. None of that happened for me until I got my job at Havana.
Yeah.
You know, and the reason why that started happening for me there is because I was enjoying it and I was really liking it and I was taking it seriously and I did want to, you know, expand my skill set. And so then, you know, I got encouragement from Nick Braun, who I've talked about on the podcast before, and another and the chef there as well, Trevor, and then the other friend of mine that I kind of knew peripherally before I started working there, Peter Corneluk. Like all of those guys, I got encouragement from them to continue to try to learn the next thing before, you know, before I would get there. And then what you kind of quickly realize too is that like most of the time in the service industry, like you're not really going to get a promotion because you are like, hey, one day I want to work on the grill station, so I'm going to watch the grill station and you know, see how that works. And then one day, you know, like they'll just let me try it out for 10 minutes or something. What happens is you show up for work one day, the grill cook's not there.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like, do you think you can cook the grill station? And then you're like, I guess so. And yeah. then somebody kind of holds your hand through it, and then suddenly you're a grill cook. But like, yeah. I mean, and I think that that's a technique for like kitchen managers too. Like, get the people, even if you're not moving them up, get the people who might, you know, be interested in working another station, get them, you know, get them interested in it, get them starting to learn about it so that when you are in that spot and you need to move somebody up, you've got somebody in the wings. And
I've been in some situations where it's kind of like all of the positions are ripe for the picking. And if you learn them, you just wait, like you said, you just wait for someone to not show up.
That's but like then a couple weeks, somebody's going to not show up.
But I've been in other kitchens where there's an established cook who understands that and is quite protective of the station and is not right. really forthcoming with the details.
And it's true. That does happen too, where there are cooks who don't want you to know their job because they're afraid that you're going to take it from them. Mm-hmm.
So sorry, at Daddy-O, so fry cook and pan cook and building sandwiches and expediting, and my promotion to expediting is exactly that. Like someone showed up late for the last time, and they were terminated that morning. It was a Saturday morning before a busy Saturday service. And that morning I got a raise and I got moved, and I got moved to expediter, and it was
fun,
like basically thrilling, like basically like rookie gets the call. It's a really busy, a really fast lunch service.
Kid, you're going up to the majors.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really fun.
Cool.
But anyways, the second lesson, if we can call it that, from Kim was sometime late in the summer when I was working at Daddy-O, Lisa and I ate at Jack's Grill, which was a fine dining restaurant. At the time, it was located in Lendrum Plaza. It's where it was where the Glass Monkey is now. And in its heyday, it was a fairly renowned Edmonton destination and pretty cutting edge for.
Yeah, I would say it was like considered one of the best restaurants in Edmonton in its heyday.
I think through the 90s and early 2000s, I think it was for sure. So I ate there, and the meal, it just everything about it kind of blew my brain. It was the first time I had had foie gras and duck confit and bone marrow and all these things, and it was in such a fun, I don't know, like the dining room was like really slick and polished, but the service was casual, and there was, we've had this conversation before, there was crayons, like there was white paper and crayons on the tables and stuff like that.
I always forget about that. I ate there a couple times too.
Yeah. So I mentioned this meal that I had at Jack's Grill to Kim, and he was like, oh yeah, you should work there. You should, as soon as you have learned what you need to learn from Daddy-O, you should go to Jack's. Just go, just like walk in the door and say you'll work there and see what happens. And so I did, right sometime in December, before Jack's opened, literally just walked in the front door. There was a server like setting tables, and I just asked if I could talk to the chef. And so we went and got him, and it was Ben Chalmers at the time. And so it was December, and I had the year or two experience at Hulbert's and Daddy-O. I was slated to start culinary school in January. So I told Ben, like, this is my resume. I've eaten here. I loved my meal. I'll do whatever you guys need. I'll wash dishes. I'll clean floors, whatever you want. I would love to be a part of this kitchen team. And as luck would have it, there was a dishwasher position just recently opened.
like that day, probably.
I don't remember the specifics, but I started washing dishes at Jack's. And I think if I remember right, I washed dishes there through that Christmas season and through my first term of culinary school. just waiting for someone to honestly
just
I was
waiting for somebody to slip up. Just got your eyes on the salad station the whole time and just like,
I mean,
keeping that dish machine running, and every time it's full you just like,
yeah, salad station looks like they're a little backed up. Maybe I could help.
Did you, in their kitchen, does the dishwasher do things like plate desserts and stuff like that? That's like a pretty common.
At the time, no. Not as a part of daily practice. I was, and to be honest, I was like quite intimidated by the kitchen and menu and crew. Like whatever, they were very,
right,
very kind and generous to me. But like I really felt like I was out of my depth in terms of the food that they were preparing at the time.
Right.
And so the first time I remember,
yeah, it's a totally different situation from something like Daddy.
Yeah, totally. Like, yeah, absolutely.
There are a lot more components, and there are a lot more things that they have to make to order, and there's a lot more
So
it's just a different world.
I don't know if it was actually the first time that I handled food there, but like I'm sure I would have peeled potatoes or something. But like the first time I remember actually touching food was Entremets a little bit behind going into a service, and they asked me to cut a hotel, like portion a hotel pan of potato pave. And I like had a ruler out, and I was like freaking out about right angles and 2.5 by whatever. I don't know what the dimensions were, but but it is kind of like we were talking about, like eventually if you work there and you do a good job, like you're going to be exposed to new skills and the like. But and then I think after my first term, so like in the spring of the following year, I was allowed to cook, allowed to put on a white jacket and cook, and worked the appetizer station or something. Yeah.
And how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years, but it was there, it was basically the exact 2 years that I was in culinary school. And so like when I was in class, I would work 2 or 3 shifts a week. And then when I was out of class, I would work full time.
Cool. And then why did you wind up leaving there?
A former cook there, Mike Scorgi, was opening, or he had opened, I guess, a food truck. And he and I had gotten on well at Jack's, and I just wanted a change. And it was like when the food truck scene in Edmonton was kind of like
popping.
Yeah. It was the hot new thing. And it sounded really fun and lots of kind of freedom. And So I left Jack's to work with Mike at the Nomad food truck.
Totally.
Yeah.
Were you sad when you left Jack's? Or were you ready to, go?
I think I could, I'm sure I could have learned more there still. I think like on paper, I had progressed through all of the stations, but I just wanted to try something different. Yeah.
Yeah. And so do you want to talk about Nomad, or is that like past the point of your first cooking experiences? Like the first three are like the formative ones, and then you were off on your career, or what?
It's kind of silly, but that is sort of how I see it.
Yeah. I think it's a legit way to
because it see that would have been almost four. Those first three jobs would have encompassed almost 4 years. I feel like maybe I glossed over it, but like at Jack's, like there were shifts, I think, where I learned more about line cooking than I had over the many months previous doing other jobs. Like being put on Entremetier with Ben Chalmers at on grill. Like I didn't quite know what I was getting into, but like I really think that, you know, when crunch time came and it's like we're getting set up for service, and Ben like very graciously but with intensity taught me how to set up the Entre Metier line so that we were ready in time for service. That was like one of the most compressed
learning experiences.
Exactly, yeah. And something that just stuck with me for, well, to the present day. Yeah.
Yeah, because now you can do that on your own or something, you know, like after you go that through that a few times with somebody else showing you how to do it, then I mean, you either stay in a situation where you have somebody show you how to do it all the time, or you like also then you don't just learn the skill of that actual setup, you learn the skill of figuring out how to apply that to setting up other stations, and then you become self-sufficient, right. And then you figure out how to design the stations so that they can be set up, and you know, yeah. Ben, I like Ben.
Yep.
So he was the like chef de cuisine when you were there, or he was like just he was the head chef. What was this? What was his job? I didn't realize that he was like the head honcho in that kitchen.
Yeah, he was.
Or was he
like,
a sous chef?
So. If I don't know the exact timeline, but my understanding is that very shortly before I started there, I think maybe even the summer before I started there or the fall, the original chef proprietor of Jack's Grill, who is Peter Jackson, had sold the restaurant to new owners and so Ben was the head chef. Like the owners weren't, they weren't chefs and they weren't in the kitchen. Ben was the,
okay,
Ben was
you.
The head chef. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's that.
And the rest is
it's history. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like my story is kind of sad. It's like I knew that I did enjoy cooking, but I just couldn't I couldn't let myself enjoy
right.
it or something. I don't know, it's weird.
It sounds like a romantic tragedy in some ways,
sort of. It's like I had other aspirations that, you know, I don't know, not that those other aspirations never amounted to anything or couldn't amount to anything, but like, yeah, it's sort of like I had something right in front of me that, you know, that was like beautiful, and I was just like, no, you're just a dirty old rock. But
you
but
had
really
to,
it was a diamond.
Yeah, you have to love the one you're with, Jill.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.